Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, January 16th. I'm your reader, Denise. Iowans not discouraged by record cold caucus. You don't get this chance very often, once in every 4 years, by Marissa Payne, the Gazette. A late emerging dark horse candidate upended 2024 GOP presidential hopeful's final weekend to deliver closing pitches to Iowa voters and was expected to have chilling effect on turnout in Monday night's caucuses. The surprise contender? Blizzard conditions that blanketed the state in snow and ushered in frosty winds, making it the coldest caucus day on record. Wind chills reached as low as minus 40 degrees, and roads still were icy Monday. A significant winter storm dumped 7 to 15 inches of snow on eastern Iowa, the National Weather Service reported. Temperatures will remain sub-zero, and wind gusts of 15 to 20 miles per hour were expected to continue through this morning to create dangerous wind chills of minus 25 to minus 40 and increased risk of frostbite in just 10 minutes. Candidates vying to be the Republican Party's presidential nominee pleaded with voters to brave the cold and roads to venture to their caucus site and vote for the candidate they want to challenge President Joe Biden for the White House this November. While some GOP officials predicted record turnout, experts suspected the life-threatening extreme weather would drive down the number of Iowans who showed up for the caucuses. The weather was expected to test voters' loyalty to the candidates. Presidential hopefuls retooled their campaign schedules for the weekend because of the weather, canceling some events or moving them online. Hours before the caucuses started at 7 p.m. Monday, only Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Ohio biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy made last-minute stops in Cedar Rapids. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and former President Donald Trump already were in central Iowa for watch parties in Des Moines, though Haley made it to Cedar Rapids for one final visit this past weekend. At an Indianola campaign rally Sunday, Trump urged supporters to caucus no matter the risks, even if it costs their lives. "If you're sick as a dog, you say, 'Darlin', I gotta make it,'" Trump told the attendees, according to the Associated Press. "Even if you vote and then pass away, it's worth it." Those who didn't let the elements discourage them from attending candidate events Monday afternoon largely said the weather didn't concern them or wouldn't affect their caucus plans. In Ramaswamy's last Cedar Rapids stop at Lion Bridge Brewing Company, most of the room was packed full of attendees, and media raised their hands to signal they were committed to the political newcomer. But about a dozen still undecided caucus-goers were among them. "Hand warmers for tonight," one volunteer asked attendees, offering free ones to help caucus-goers stay warm. "As long as Iowans have been showing up in a blizzard or not, we've been showing up as well, because that's the way it's supposed to work," Ramaswamy said, encouraging people to persuade at least 10 people they know to caucus Monday night. People would drive 12 to 15 miles through ice and snow to their caucus sites because they care about this country, he told reporters afterwards. "We have not degraded into total apathy," Ramaswamy said. Wrapped in an Iowa Hawkeye scarf, Robin Tucker, 59, of Cedar Rapids, said he's serving as the caucus chair for the site at Faith Presbyterian Church in southeast Cedar Rapids. He has heard from people who don't plan to caucus because of the weather. "I'm concerned about the streets," Tucker said, noting that there were some Cedar Rapids street closures on roads the storm rendered impassable last weekend. "I hope people do get out." Sid Mills, 70, of North Liberty, said he took back roads around Swisher to see Ramaswamy speak. "Barring minus 100 degree weather," he said, "temperatures would not affect his plans to vote." He plans to caucus for Ramaswamy as he's looking to cast aside the drama of current and former presidential administrations. "We need serious change at the top level on down," Mills said. "I believe at this time Vivek's the only one who can do that." Jeff Dutton, 54, of Cedar Rapids, said he believes Ramaswamy has the youth and energy for the presidency, unlike Trump or Biden, and was committed to supporting him. He, too, was confident Iowans would venture outside to get to their caucus sites. It's important enough for people in Iowa that they'll brave it, Dutton said. At Jersey's Pub and Grub, DeSantis said he asked his oldest daughter if she still prefers the snow to the weather and beaches in Florida. His children were initially excited by the snow, something different from the tropical climate their home state offers. The crowd laughed, hearing her response, "Daddy, I like the snow, but it's way too cold for me." "We don't know how many people are going to be able to turn out, given the weather," DeSantis said. "If you're going out to caucus and you bring a friend or two between now and then, that's going to make a big, big difference. Take advantage of the opportunity to change the trajectory of this country," Ruth Mackey, 71, of Cedar Rapids, said. She's been torn between DeSantis and Haley, but was strongly leaning towards supporting DeSantis. She thinks his support of a 6-week ban on abortions is too extreme. Otherwise, she said she was impressed with policies he's implemented in Florida. Citing Haley's refrain that Trump was the right man for the right time, she said she disliked the way Trump treated people he works with, so she hopes she doesn't have to hold her nose and support him again in the 2024 general election. She was unsure how the weather might affect turnout, but said she wouldn't dissuade her from caucusing. "You don't get this chance very often, once every 4 years," Mackey said. When former UN Ambassador Haley made her closing pitch to Iowa voters in Cedar Rapids late last week, Tricia Sheldon, 68, a retired registered nurse from Shellsburg, trudged through the snow to see her. Sheldon, a registered Republican, said she's committing to supporting Haley on Monday night, bitterly cold or not. "This is the most important thing we do as Iowans, in my opinion," she said. "I listen to the issues and vote for the person. And I just think it's the coolest thing to be watching, you know, morning news TV, and there's the guy I just sat with, or a woman I just listened to. I like getting out. I think it's important for Iowans to do that." A majority of polls showed Trump leading his nearest Republican rival in the caucuses by more than 30 percentage points. Sheldon said she's baffled by Trump's cult following in the state. Should Trump win the nomination and it come down to a rematch of 2020 against Biden, she said, "I'll be voting for Biden." "I think he's going to ruin our country," Sheldon said of Trump. "I think he's done so many horrible things to tear our country apart, and he just continues doing it. And with the criminal indictments he's got against him, it's like I do not understand how anybody with any intelligence could vote for a man like him." Asked how a Republican primary challenger, including Haley, can successfully push back against Trump's following, Sheldon said, "All I can do is support her and vote for her and push towards the caucus." Tom Barton and Aaron Jordan contributed to this report. Comments to 319-398-8494, Marissa, Marissa dot Payne, Payne, at thegazette.com. Signs of caucus all over his baseball collection. Mark Korver of Washington, Iowa, gathers names of presidential hopefuls as they visit the state. By Brittany Miller, The Gazette. 39 signed baseballs. That's how many Mike Korver of Washington, Iowa has in his collection to date, and they all follow a theme. Each has been signed by a presidential candidate. One has a scrawl of President Joe Biden. Scribbles on another belong to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. A cursive signature reads Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. It marks one of the most expansive and unusual political collections in Iowa. And the 39-year-old casino security guard has no intentions to stop adding to it. "I'm not planning on selling this unless I pass away," Korver said. "It's an interesting way for me to remember politics, get involved, and meet the candidate." The collection is bipartisan. Korver doesn't consider himself a Republican or a Democrat, he said. He only identifies as an American. He has wielded his American right to vote during every general election he can, and recently has made a statement doing so. He wears an American flag suit to the political events he attends. Donning the stars and stripes is both for fun and in hopes it brightens candidates' days. I've never had a candidate tell me they didn't like it, Korver said. I always think that's a plus. He caucused for the first time only in 2016. He ended up voting for former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, who came in 11th in the Republican caucuses. In 2020, he wanted to experience how the Democrats ran their presidential races. He saw more than 20 candidates as they passed through Iowa. He ended up caucusing for Warren, who came in third, and then voting for the Libertarian nominee Joe Jorgensen in the presidential election. This election cycle, Korver has seen nearly every Republican candidate who has visited Iowa. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who suspended his presidential bid Wednesday, is an exception since he didn't visit Iowa during his campaign. Korver also is missing the signature of former President Donald Trump, as baseballs generally are not allowed into his campaign events, as well as Vice President Kamala Harris. This cycle, Korver has attended the most events for Republican presidential candidate and entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, who he planned to caucus for Monday. He first saw Ramaswamy at an Osceola event and fell in love with him as a contender. He's a very inspiring dude, Korver said. He made me love my country more, and if a guy can do that for a guy that wears a flag suit, I think he'd be a decent guy for the White House. It's important to him how presidential candidates treat attendees at their events. He liked how Ramaswamy gave the audience time to speak to him, ask questions, and air concerns. In contrast, he didn't appreciate GOP candidate and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley's recent comments at a New Hampshire campaign event, where she told the crowd its primary voters had the opportunity to correct the results of the Iowa caucuses. Iowa GOP leaders criticized the candidate for the remark, and so did Korver. This isn't a joke to me. The flag suit is worn for fun, but it's how I decide who I want to caucus for and ultimately vote for in the general election, he said. If Vivek has dropped out, my vote was not going to her. Since the Gazette last interviewed Korver in 2019, he has grown to care more about health care. A health issue forced him into an emergency room and he walked out with a bill just under $3,000, even with the help of insurance. That will be a factor toward his political decision. He'll continue to practice his right to vote for as long as he can, always thinking of what his high school government teacher told him. If you don't vote, you don't have a valid reason to complain, and there's no plan on stopping his expansive collection either. As long as I've got two legs, good health, a working car, and baseballs are still around, I'll go see candidates, Korver said. Comments to 319-398-8370, Brittany, Brittney, @thegazette.com. ISU to investigate exercise impact on depression. There are lots of people who don't want to do medication-based treatment, by Vanessa Miller, The Gazette. With mounting scientific evidence showing exercise can reduce stress, anxiety, and symptoms of depression, one Iowa State University associate professor wants to know why and how, and whether the type and amount of exercise matters. If we can figure out what's going on, then we can maximize those mechanisms and come up with the best program or prescription for an individual with anxiety or depression, said ISU associate professor of kinesiology Jacob Meyer, who recently landed two National Institute of Mental Health grants, providing him resources to try to answer those questions. The longer of the two projects, a $3.6 million five-year study, gives him 3 years to recruit 200 adults with depression for a 16-week trial to test whether resistance training, also known as weight training, can be helpful as aerobic exercise like running or biking has been shown to be. The second, a $1.5 million two-year study, aims to explore whether and how exercise might amplify benefits of therapy. One of the biggest issues with mental health treatment is that there are lots of people who don't want to do medication-based treatments or who want to have some alternatives to medication-based treatments, Meyer said. So we're really trying to figure out what are the best options for people. especially if they're interested in a non-pharmacological approach to improve their depression. Does weightlifting help? These inquiries are a continuation of Meyer's year-long look into the impact of exercise on depression. Which winter months can amplify, with its dark days, gray skies, Arctic temperatures, and heavy snow keeping people indoors for days? From 2020 to 2022, Meyer and his ISU team led smaller pilot studies that produced promising results, finding, among other things, that 30 minutes of exercise might reduce depression symptoms for at least 75 minutes after workout and also amplify therapy benefits. That led to the grant proposals for these larger projects that have since been funded, Meyer said, and now we're hoping that we're off to the races to figure out. The newly funded resistance exercise study started recruitment this month in hopes of answering three key questions over the next 5 years. Does weight training reduce symptoms of depression? If so, does the reason have to do with blood flow to the brain and within the brain? And is it possible to identify who would benefit most from weight training? There's a lot of research that suggests people with mental health conditions have areas of the brain that are either underactivated or overactivated, and we think it's possible there is some re-regulation of brain blood flow patterns through resistance exercise training that may mediate reductions in depression and anxiety, Meyer said. Each participant will be randomly assigned to a low-dose or high-dose version of resistance training, all performed in ISU's Wellness and Exercise Laboratory, which Meyer directs. By splitting the participants into two groups, he said, researchers will be able to observe whether the benefit is coming from doing any workout at all, or whether weightlifting specifically is helping. We're going to see if there's something in particular that's helpful about working out at a higher amount versus a lower amount, he said, because it's quite possible that just coming in, working out with somebody twice a week, all the social factors, the planning, all the stuff you have to do, all of that might be what actually is helping to address the depression. If the high-dose group is doing better, then we're pretty sure that there's some specific, unique benefits to that higher resistance mode that's resulting in the benefit. Like, for example, the way sets and reps involved in weight training provide inconsistent but patterned demands on the vascular system. That type of demand differs from the consistent blood flow produced during aerobic exercise. ISU researchers will use non-invasive tools such as Doppler ultrasound to study participants' brain blood flow, while also taking data on the structure and function of blood vessels in the neck that flow to the brain. This comprehensive approach gives the team the best chance of identifying the effects of major depressive disorder on brain blood flow and the ability of resistance exercise to improve brain blood flow in this group, according to the ISU Assistant Professor of Kinesiology, Wes Lefferts, who will lead a team of graduate students in measuring study participants' brain blood flow. Can exercise enhance therapy? The separate study on whether exercise can amplify the benefits of therapy began in November and is running to 2025. Meyer also is leading that research, consisting of an 8-week randomized control trial involving 40 adults with major depressive disorder, also called clinical depression. Every week, participants will either do a moderately intense workout for 30 minutes before meeting with a therapist or rest quietly before their therapy session. The question is whether exercise can prime or fertilize the brain to engage with emotionally challenging work. That one is nice because it uses exercise to potentially enhance the therapy itself, Meyer said. It's not really looking at exercise as a treatment. Instead, it's using exercise to get somebody into the right frame of mind to then walk into a therapy clinic and have a better experience in therapy. Given the research is based in the ISU Wellness Lab, Meyer said his team is recruiting largely from Central Iowa region. For the therapy project, people come in once a week, he said, For the resistance training project, they come in twice a week, so there's some amount of time commitment. But should findings produce new tools and guides for non-pharmaceutical depression aids, their impact could be much farther reaching. In Iowa in particular, our mental health care system is pretty strapped in terms of opportunity, Meyer said. There's often a really long wait list. It can be difficult to get into a provider, but especially if there's something like a resistance exercise program that doesn't require a psychiatrist or a psychologist to run it, it might sort of expand the pool of treatment options and also the ability for people to engage with those treatment options. ISU-licensed psychologist and associate chair of psychology, Nathaniel Wade, cited another rewarding aspect of the research, that we have the chance to really help people while we are testing new approaches, Wade said. In past clinical research, the participants have found significant relief and healing, all while adding to our scientific understanding. Comments to 319-339-3158. Vanessa, V-A-N-E-S-S-A, Miller, at the Gazette. Iowa Appeals Court upholds conviction in trooper slaying. Grundy Center man shot trooper, threatened others in 2021 standoff, by Jeff Reinitz, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Grundy Center. The Iowa Court of Appeals has upheld the conviction of a Grundy Center man who shot and killed a state trooper in 2021 at his home after attacking a police officer. Michael Thomas Lang said he should have been able to claim he acted in self-defense when he shot Iowa State Patrol Sergeant Jim Smith in the chest with a shotgun in April 2021. Authorities said Lang led a Grundy Center police officer on a chase and then struggled with the officer outside of town. Lang then fled home, culminating in a standoff. Smith led a team to enter Lang's home and detain him, but Lang shot Smith and threatened to kill other officers, taking aim at the driver of an armored vehicle. A tactical team eventually detained Lang without a shootout. At trial, a judge refused to allow Lang to present a self-defense claim, siding with prosecutors who noted there is no right to use force to resist an arrest. A jury deliberated just 2 hours, found Lang guilty after a 2022 trial. On appeal, Lang's attorney argued he should have been able to claim he was acting in self-defense because law enforcement was using excessive force to the point they were no longer acting in the lawful performance of their duties. In a decision handed down Wednesday, the Iowa Court of Appeals ruled that Lang couldn't use the excessive force argument because he didn't argue the issue in district court. Lang currently is serving life in prison for first-degree murder in Smith's death, plus an additional 30 years for attempted murder and assault on an officer for attacking other officers. 2023 crop yields mostly resilient despite weather. Corn yields went up, soybeans dipped, hay plummeted. By Brittany Miller, The Gazette. After a year filled with record-breaking drought, Mississippi River flooding, and extreme heat, total crop yields in 2023 mostly held up even in the state's 22nd driest year on record, although county-level disparities aren't available yet. Total corn planted was estimated at 13.1 million acres. Corn used for grain, mostly put toward livestock feed or ethanol production, was estimated at 2.52 billion bushels, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's up 2% from 2022's 2.47 billion bushels and ranks as the fifth largest production in state history. Harvested areas grew from 12.6 million acres, about 200,000 acres more than in 2022. For the United States at large, estimated production of corn used for grain reached a record high of 15.3 billion bushels, up 12% from 2022. Iowa's bounty averaged 201 bushels per acre, trumping the country's record-breaking 177.3 bushels per acre and marking the state's fourth highest yields. Even with all the weather challenges this year, Iowa remained a production powerhouse, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Negg said in a statement. That's a testament to the assistance of timely rains, the resilience of Iowa farmers, and continuous improvements in genetics, traits, equipment, technology, production methods, and many other innovations. A smaller percentage of Iowa's planted corn for harvest was harvested for silage, which is used for forage for livestock. Silage production dipped 7% in 2023, estimated at 7.6 million tons. Yields were down 1 ton per acre compared to 2022. Producers harvested 380,000 acres of corn for silage, down 3% from 2022. Soybean production fell 2% compared with 2022 from 587 million bushels to an estimated 573 million bushels in 2023. Even with the drop, 2023 ranks as the third highest soybean production in Iowa history. Acreages of soybeans planted and harvested were each down 150,000 acres from 2022. National soybean production in 2023 totaled 4.16 billion bushels, down from 2% from 2022. Iowa's average yield of 58 bushels per acre, the fourth highest in state history, again beat out countrywide averages of 50.6 bushels per acre. Iowa's hay production took the hardest hit. Yields dropped to 2.95 million acres, down 18% from 2022, mostly attributed to drought conditions. All hay harvested acres were estimated at 1.01 million acres, a 160,000 acre dip. Brittany Miller is the Energy and Environment Reporter for the Gazette and a core member of the Report for Iowa, a national service program that places journalists in local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues. Comments to 319-398-8370, brittany.miller@thegazette.com. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Tuesday, January 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Mary E. Willem Bentley, Cedar Rapids. Mary E. Willem Bentley, 97, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died January 11th, 2024. Funeral Mass, 10:30 a.m., Thursday, January 18th. 2024 at St. Ludmilla Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Visitation 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, January 17, 2024, with a rosary service at 6 p.m. at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home, 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Visitation will continue a half hour prior to service time at the church on Thursday. Interment will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. Memorial donations may be directed to St. Ludmilla's Building Fund. Tanner Steckley, Coraville. In loving memory of Tanner Steckley, a devoted man of God and a beacon of love for his family. His life, a testament of faith and affection, ended too soon after a long struggle with mental health. Tanner's legacy of kindness and spiritual strength will forever inspire us. Tanner chose to be with his loving God on January 8, 2024, and will be greatly missed by all he knew and loved him. A visitation will take place on Thursday, January 18th at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service, 605 Kirkwood Avenue, Iowa City, from 12 to 2 p.m. A memorial service will follow at 2 p.m. In lieu of flowers, a donation may be made to the family for a memorial bench in Tanner's honor, with any additional funds to support his son's future. A full obituary is available at lensingfuneral.com. Gloria Jean Warner of Marion. Gloria Jean Warner, 83, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on Monday, January 8, 2024, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The family will greet friends from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, January 20th, 2024 at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, with a Mass to follow at 10:30 a.m. Father Dennis Conway will officiate. Burial will follow at Memory Gardens Cemetery in Iowa City, Iowa. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family with arrangements. Memorials in Gloria's memory may be directed to the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation or the Parkinson's Foundation. Please share a memory of Gloria at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Dennis Wally Usher, Cedar Rapids. Dennis Wally Usher, 79, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away Thursday, January 11, 2024, at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. Funeral service, 4 to 4:30 p.m. Friday, January 19, 2024, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. A remembrance party will immediately follow from 4:30 to 8 at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids on a later date. Dawn Lynn Dennis, 67, died Sunday, December 31, 2023. Private family services were held at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service with burial at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Private family burial took place at Linwood. Catherine Kathy Troll, 72, of Cedar Rapids, died on Friday, January 12, 2024, from lung cancer after living with it for 15 years. She never smoked. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m., Friday, January 19, 2024, at St. Mark's United Methodist Church by Pastor Bonnie Copen. Friends may visit with the family on Thursday from 4 to 7 p.m. at Tehan Funeral Home. Burial, Riverside Cemetery, Anamosa. Memorials may be given to St. Mark's Methodist Church and the Nassif Cancer Wellness Center. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.tehanfuneralhome.com. Following a prolonged illness, Linda Cole, 78, passed away Sunday, January 14, 2024, at the Hiawatha Care Center. Graveside service and celebration of life will be held at a later date. And Steve Heise Tehan Funeral Home is serving the family. An online condolences for the family may be left at www.tehanfuneralhome.com. A memorial fund has been established. Johnny Jones of Anamosa, age 89, died Sunday, January 14, 2024, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation after a brief illness. Funeral services will be held 10:30 Friday morning, January 19, 2024, at St. Paul Lutheran Church, Anamosa, with interment in the Prairie Hill Cemetery. Rural Monticello, with military honors. Friends may call 9 o'clock Friday morning at the church. Gosh Funeral Home, Anamosa, has taken John and his family in their care. Teresa Mary Huber, our beloved mom, grandmother, great-grandmother, mother-in-law, sister-in-law, and aunt passed away on January 12, 2024, at the age of 91. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, January 19, 2024, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories Stateroom in Cedar Rapids. On Saturday, January 20th, the family will greet friends and family for 1 hour before the funeral mass at 10 a.m. at St. Matthew's Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial beside her husband, Earl, will be at a later date. A memorial fund has been established in her name. Marlene K. Newhouse, 72, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away following a courageous cancer battle. January 14, 2024, at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha, Iowa. Mass of Christian burial is 10 a.m. Saturday, January 20th, 2024, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will take place at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Lending Closet at Grace Episcopal Church in Cedar Rapids or the Cedar Valley Humane Society in Marlene's name. Online condolences can be sent to the family at www.newhousefuneralservice.com. Newcomer Designs Small Towns Logo by Winona Whitaker, the Hometown Current. North English. Joseph Thorin moved his family to North English only 5 years ago, but already has left his mark on the community. It's idyllic in certain ways, and we like that about it, he said of the southeast Iowa town. Thorin's impressions and his artwork now are embodied in the city's new official logo. Thorin, 35, grew up in South Dakota near the Iowa and Minnesota borders. His wife, Abby, is from Iowa City. The couple has four children, ages 6 to 12. About 5 years ago, Thorin was working at the Kelowna Creamery and wanted to live somewhere close, but with affordable housing. He was making $15 an hour at the time, and he and his wife, Abby, wanted her to be a stay-at-home mom. North English was a town that could make that actually viable to us, Thorin said. He now is an IT auditor working remotely with national and international clients through a corporation in Georgia. He works from home, and his children are schooled at home. Revitalization Project. Laura Sauser of Iowa County Community Development began talking to North English business owners in March about revitalizing downtown. The Main Street Revitalization Committee has been meeting monthly to discuss projects and community needs. One need we determined was that the city needed a logo and a website. We were able to find an Iowa County developer to create the website, but still struggled to find the right logo, Sauser said. Joseph just happened to be at our meeting and pretty much volunteered to create one. Though not a designer by trade, Thorin is no stranger to the craft. I would describe myself as a hobbyist in graphic design, he said. Thorin's logo designs have been limited to people he knows, he said, but he has a sufficient grasp of what works in design and what doesn't. His first step was interviewing people in town, asking what North English is to them. A logo must be representative and easy to understand, Thorin said. The one he created features a tree with its large branches bending to embrace the North English water tower and a farm field, its roots cradling them from beneath. It's about the beauty of the country surrounding it. It's about growth. It's about setting down roots. Water towers are often the first thing travelers see when they approach a town and are semblance of permanence, Thorin said. Beautiful logo. Thorin prepared a packet and gave a presentation to the city council explaining his design. For the council, one thing was missing, the star that hangs over Main Street at Christmas time. No one Thorin talked to while doing research had seen the star as representative of North English, he said, but the council asked if Thorin could put a star in the logo, so he added one between the words North and English. The logo now is displayed on banners along Main Street. City Hall has two large prints of it. The Public Works Department displays a minimal version, and the city's new website features it. There are plans to have it on all water bills and communications as well, Sauser said. He created a beautiful logo that represents North English well. Pate, Pleasant Valley School Board recount broke the law. Secretary of State issues technical infraction by William Morris. A recount that resulted in a tied election in an Eastern Iowa school board race was marred by the inclusion of a number of invalid votes, the Iowa Secretary of State's office has found. Jamison Smith challenged incumbent Tracy Rivera for a seat on the Pleasant Valley School Board, and the initial count after the November 7th election showed him with a 6-vote lead. Rivera requested a recount, which reported later that month that the race actually tied 255 to 255, meaning the winner would be decided by a coin flip. But the Scott County Board of Supervisors in December refused to certify the recount, citing allegations of irregularities raised by one member of the recount panel. Rivera responded with a lawsuit December 22nd, seeking to compel the board to accept the recount result. In a letter dated January 5th, Secretary of State Paul Pate's office said the recounts, in fact, did err by counting some votes that, by law, should have been invalid. Pate is issuing a technical infraction to the recount board, with his chief counsel, Eric Gukin, writing that all relevant materials clearly instructed the members on which votes were or were not to be counted. Because none of the panel members are county supervisors, no one will be imposed for the violation, a spokesperson for Pate confirmed. What was wrong with the disputed votes? Under Iowa law, when using an optical scan voting machine, voters must fill in the oval, known as a target, on the ballot for their candidate of choice, even if there is a write-in to cast a valid vote. Rivera ran as a write-in candidate due to a problem with her nomination petition. In the resulting recount, the panel allegedly counted several ballots on which voters had written Rivera's name but failed to mark the target oval to indicate a write-in vote was being cast. Recount panel member Cindy Dirks objected to at least one of these ballots but was overruled by the other two members. Dirks, who was chosen for the panel by Smith's campaign, told the Register she became aware of the problem toward the end of the recount and objected at that time. Another panel member, retired Judge Mark Smith, in an email to the Scott County Auditor, accused Dirks of strategically waiting until the final write-in ballot, which would have made it a tie, to raise her objection, and said that he and fellow panel member Aaron Paluta felt it was unfair to count the other ballots in the same situation and not this one. Paluta, who was appointed by Rivera's campaign, and Smith did not respond to emails asking for their response to the technical infraction report or the contested recount process. Confusion, accusations over filing recount report. In her lawsuit against the county, Rivera accused Dirks of taking the recount report signed by all panel members back from the auditor and later filing it after making unauthorized changes without the signature of the other two panelists. Dirks, in an interview, said that's not what happened. After disagreeing over the improperly marked ballot, she said, she asked the Scott County Auditor to come provide guidance only for Paluta and Smith to lead before the attorney arrived. The document the other two added their signatures to had been her scratch tally sheet, she said, which she took home because she believed the panel still needed to meet to resolve the disputed ballots and prepare a clean copy of its final report. The three of us should have gotten together, cleaned up the notes, transferred it to another sheet for all three of us to look at and sign it. That's not what happened, said Dirks, who added that she'd been an election volunteer for 2 decades in Scott County. I didn't figure my scratch sheet was the report, she said. Like I said, there's a lot missing from the report, like everything. Those are notes. In court filings, Alan Ostergren, a prominent Iowa Republican election lawyer representing Smith's campaign, said the supposedly final report is indeed missing some of the information required by law, and that the Scott County Board was justified in rejecting the recount based on obvious clerical errors in the tally lists. Smith remains winner for now. Ashley Hunt, communications director for Pate's office, said Smith remains the certified election winner based on the original vote canvas. Asked if Pate takes a position on whether the county board should have certified the recount, Hunt said Pate's office has not issued an infraction to the board and will let the legal process take its course. If that were to happen, though, it would likely tee up another election lawsuit from Smith. In a November letter to Scott County Auditor Carrie Tompkins, Ostergren warned that any outcome declaring Rivera the winner will surely be overturned in an election process proceeding. The disputed 2023 election comes after a previous election controversy in Scott County in 2022. Republican Luana Stoltenberg won election to a state house district that year after 2 recounts showed her with 11-vote edge, a process that found sizable disparities between machine and hand counts of the ballots. In sports, boys wrestling, Kennedy's Falk pins his way to Jayhawk title. Cougars win 3 titles and place 2nd to Hempstead in team race. By K.J. Pilcher, Cedar Rapids Gazette. Colin Falk earned a state medal last season. The hardware comes with more confidence, higher expectations, and a determined attitude as a Cedar Rapids Kennedy wrestler chases his goal. The goal is always to get first at state, Falk said. I have a little chip on my shoulder because I placed last year, so I need to get it done again this year. Falk was dominant Monday, pinning his way to the 165-pound title at the 50th Jayhawk Invitational Boys Wrestling Tournament at Cedar Rapids Jefferson. The competition was originally scheduled for Saturday and postponed due to weather. Falk posted a 5-0 record, ending each by fall in the first period. His longest match lasted just 1 minute and 37 seconds. Class 3A, number 7 Falk, ended the day with a 1 minute, 4 second pin over Marshalltown's Dalton Zednicek. "I didn't do very well at the last tournament, so this is a good bounce back for me," said Falk, who was a runner-up at the Jack Mendenhall Invitational on January 6th in Ames. "I thought I wrestled well. I felt like I did what I needed to get done. I pinned my way through the bracket. I think that was good for me." The Mendenhall finish motivated him during practice as he worked on his endurance and technique. He was focused to improve his footwork and crate action with his motion, not relying solely on hand fighting to get up his offense, to set up his offense. Falk responded well. "We threw every coach at him," Kennedy coach Nick LeClaire said. "I wrestled him this week. He gained some confidence, took it to another level to where we would really start trying hard. He started putting it to us a little and made us give him a harder go. If he wrestles like that, he's going to be a handful coming down to the last stretch of the season. That's what I saw today." LeClaire said he was impressed by his level changes, creating opportunities to score. He opened opponents up for attacks by moving his feet better in the short time he was on the mat. Falk has been receptive to changes to improve and get closer to his ultimate goal. "He's being coachable," LeClaire said. "He's open to it. I think it's working. We have to stay at it." Cale Smithart at 150 and 175-pounder Christian Gasper also won titles for Kennedy, which placed second in the team race with 195 points, 42.5 behind champion Dubuque Hempstead. The tournament opened with a tribute to the tournament's rich history. Former Jefferson wrestlers Jim Belvans and Tom Sadler and their coach Bill McNeil were recognized at the start. Belvans, Sadler, and Jed Brown, who was unable to attend, were individual champions at the inaugural tournament in 1975. McNeil coached Jefferson to state titles in 1973 and 74 before starting the annual invitational. Along with McNeil, former Jefferson coaches Dick Briggs, Matt Orton, and Tim Fowler were honored for their contributions to the event over the years. All three were former Jayhawk wrestlers. Fowler wrestled for Hall of Fame coach Gary Kurtlemeyer at Jefferson and the University of Iowa. Sports Day events of area interest: girls basketball, Linmar at Liberty, 7:30 p.m. Independence at Marion, 7:15 p.m. Western Dubuque at Prairie, 7:30 p.m. Dubuque Hempstead at Jefferson, 7:30 p.m. Waterloo West at Xavier, 7:30 p.m. Cedar Falls at City High, 7:30 p.m. Kennedy at Dubuque Senior, 7:30 p.m. Washington at Dubuque Wallert, 7:30 p.m. Regina at Wilton, 6 p.m. Boys basketball, Liberty at Linmar, 7:30 p.m. Dubuque Senior at Kennedy, 7:30 p.m. Dubuque Wallert at Washington, 7:30 p.m. Marion at Independence, 7:15 p.m. Prairie at Western Dubuque, 7:30 p.m. Jefferson at Dubuque Hempstead, 7:30 p.m. Xavier at Waterloo West, 7:30 p.m. City High at Cedar Falls, 7:30 p.m. Regina at Wilton, 7:30 p.m. Women's basketball, Wisconsin at Iowa, 8 p.m. Men's basketball, Iowa State at BYU, 8 p.m. On the radio, men's basketball, Iowa State at BYU, 7 p.m., KGYM. Local talk shows, Todd Brommelkamp Show, 6:30 a.m., KGYM. Gym class, 3 p.m., KGYM. Spencer on Sports, 4 p.m., KGYM. Girls basketball, Monday, Metro, Iowa City. Iowa City Liberty at Maquoketa postponed. Iowa City West at Dubuque-Hempstead postponed. In the area, Benton Community 58, Independence 32. BGM at Iowa Valley postponed. Cascade at Bellevue postponed. Central City at Alcater Central postponed. Denver at Vinton-Shelsburg postponed. Grinnell at Fairfield canceled. Highland at Lone Tree postponed. Jessup at Sumner-Fredericksburg postponed. Meskwaki at South Tama postponed. Starmont at Clayton Ridge postponed. South Winneshiek at Crestwood postponed. Tipton at West Liberty postponed. Waterloo-Columbus at North Hampton postponed. West Central Valley at Colfax Mingo postponed. Wilton at Sigourney postponed. Bowling leagues, Cedar Rapids Bowling League Center. Golfers Bowling League, Elaine Edens, 203. Barb Andrews, 505. May City Bowl, Saints and Sinners. Tracy McShane, 210 to 551. Lon Pepper, 259. Tim Sebastian, 729. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Tuesday, January 16th. I'm your reader, Denise. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now, researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.